Welcome back to the Running Wine Mom podcast. I'm your host, Samantha Salinsky, aka the Running Wine Mom. I'm thrilled to have you join us for a special episode today as we dive into the world of food safety and the sweet delights we all love, particularly chocolate. As we approach the Easter season, a time when many families indulge in chocolate treats, we have a noteworthy discussion lined up. Our guest today is the esteemed Dr. James Rogers, Director of Food Safety Research and Testing at Consumer Reports, a prominent figure in the field of food safety. We'll be exploring his insights into the industry, the recent testing on heavy metals in chocolate, and the implications for our health. So without further ado, let's jump in. Welcome, James.
Yeah, thank you for having me today.
Yes, thank you so much for coming on. I am so excited to learn about all that you have to teach us. Mm-hmm. So to start each episode, we have our wine, and win of the week segment. This is where we share our favorite bottle of wine or drink, then about something that has been bothering us and celebrate our recent victories. So grab a glass, take a deep breath, and let's get started. So what is your wine or W-I-N-E or drink of the week?
So I don't drink. So my favorite drink is usually an Anna Palmer made with unsweet tea and real lemonade.
I love that. That is definitely a good one. I like the unsweetened iced tea with a little bit of the sweetness to it from the lemonade. Mm-hmm. And what is your W-I-N-E of the week?
Well, right now is all the sicknesses going on with the upper respiratory infections, because I was sick the entire Christmas holiday. Then my wife got sick, and then now my son's sick. And I'm a recovering COVID patient. And so it really, really worried me. I tested negative this time, but I still was under the weather for a long time. And I still have a little bit of catch right here. But, you know, that's my wine for the day.
Well, I hope you all feel better. I feel like it's everywhere, especially in this, you know, winter season. What is your win of the week?
Well, I guess it's this story. This story, and then we also had a story come out recently, was plastics in your food.
Okay.
And so I've just been doing a number of interviews, podcasts like yours, trying to educate consumers about these different aspects of food safety. And so I'm very happy that consumers seem to be liking what we put out as an organization and are interested in learning more about it. Additionally, with people like you within the podcast world, the news world, et cetera. So it's a win-win for my team and I, and for the organization.
Yeah. And it's so important. And I definitely do a lot of research like around food and what we're feeding. We have a 3-year-old and an 18-month-old. So feeding them, we're not perfect with like the organic or everything, but just being knowledgeable in what we should or shouldn't be feeding our children. And what's out there is very important to me.
Well, hopefully you have looked at our articles on baby food testing and the recommendations we've made. And so we try to help out in that area also.
Yeah, that's definitely something that's since I've had, I mean, my oldest is only 3, but I feel as though like every 6 months there's like an article or something that will come out like, you know, don't feed them this or don't feed them that. So to keep up on everything is a little scary, but also very important. So I always like to ask my guests, what is one struggle you've overcome leading to where you are? And what's one thing you're most proud of in your life?
The struggle probably would be is really trying to figure out what I wanted to do. When I started out my education, even when I just started as an undergrad, my goal was to become an assistant professor at a historically Black college or university. I ended up getting my PhD from Michigan. I did some postdoctoral work, and then I was actually an assistant professor at a college, and it just didn't fit me. So if you look at my resume or my LinkedIn profile, you'll see I've wandered a little bit professionally, but I've had fun. I've enjoyed it. I've learned a lot, and I'm really enjoying myself at Consumer Reports, but it just took me a minute to figure out what I was supposed to do professionally in this world. And but gladly it worked out for me.
I love that you didn't stop and settle for anything. That's, I think, one of the most important things in life, to not get stagnant and keep moving and pushing yourself to be better and do better.
Yeah, I'm a very curious person by nature. So
so this is the Running Wine Mom podcast. So we'd like to start off with some fitness. What is your favorite way to stay active?
So I tend to rely on walking as much as I can, walking around my neighborhood, walking on the treadmill, walking in the trails around here. And then I also do water aerobics. I'm a member of a gym that has an excellent warm therapy pool. And so I like to do that and then get in the whirlpool, get in the steam room. Then that tends to be my workout.
Yeah, that's great. The gym that I belong to, mm-hmm. they're actually redoing the whole inside pool and the therapy pool. So mm-hmm. they have an outdoor pool and they've kept mm-hmm. it heated for the whole winter. Mm-hmm. And we had the opportunity they had a whole kids thing. So mm-hmm. last week in the freezing cold, we're out there in the 85 degree mm-hmm. water, which was just a fun experience. But they're still having outdoor classes even in the winter mm-hmm. here.
Yeah, and I even tried pickleball for a little while, but it just didn't catch on. I mean, I'm a longtime tennis player, but I messed up my back, and so I had to drop tennis, and I said, okay, pickleball, but it just wasn't the same.
Yeah, pickleball is huge. My brother mm-hmm. is very into pickleball, and I'm mm-hmm. a high school health and phys ed teacher, and that's something that we just bought pickleball sets to start to teach mm-hmm. the kids for the spring, which I'm excited for. Mm-hmm. So how do you stay motivated to maintain your fitness routine?
Well, I have, and we may talk about this later, I have 5 kids and I expect to have grandkids at some point. So I want to be there for them. I want to be there to be able to play with them. And also I want to have a healthy retirement with my wife. We love to travel. And so I want to have the physical ability to actually do these things and realize these things. And so that's my motivation. I mean, I'm not a bodybuilder, so I don't really care that much how I look, but I do care about the fitness level that I'm in. And I try very hard to eat well, to exercise, get enough sleep, do mental health exercises just to keep it positive and moving so that, again, I can see my grandchildren.
And that is so important. And as, having 2 young kids, my parents are so actively involved with mm-hmm. with their grandkids. And that's something that they talk about all the time. They're so happy and proud of themselves for being able to keep themselves in shape all those years so that mm-hmm. they can play with the kids as much as they do. And they are very active with them. Mm-hmm. So to go a little bit more in depth into your family, we then on the podcast move into the parenthood. So why don't you tell us about your family?
So I have a blended family of 5 children. I bought 2 into the union. My wife, Lisa, works at the Environmental Protection Agency here in D.C. Within my 5 kids, I have 1 person who's in medical school.
Wow. That's
I have awesome. 1 person who's a fundraiser for a major nonprofit in New York City. I have 1 who's a cook and we're trying to get to go to culinary school. I have 1 who is about to graduate from college in information science. And then I have 1 who is works on the support staff of a major law firm in D.C. And so I just feel so lucky and blessed that everyone's doing so well.
Yeah, definitely not successful.
Yeah. And out of 5 kids so far, everybody's been doing very, very well. So I'm very, very happy about that and feel blessed about that.
What a great, that's awesome. That's so, mm-hmm. such a great testament to your parenting as well to have successful mm-hmm. kids. I'm sure it's such a great ending to you because you mm-hmm. don't know, you know, when you're raising them, hopefully you're doing everything right.
You do not know.
Right. But now you know you did a lot right. Mm-hmm. So what do you think your parenting style is?
Well, one of the big aspects is to communicate as much as possible, as often as possible. I mean, I have at least the 2 I brought in when we merged families, they were a little bit older. But in raising them both with their mother and then as a divorced father, my whole goal was to always have an open door and talk to them. And so I say talk, talk, talk. And so they know that if ever they need to talk to me, I'm available. I'll put down the controller, turn off the TV, whatever. We talk in the car, we talk on trips. And I only had 2 rules. Number 1, I will not share a secret that I have with someone else if they ask me to hold the confidence. And number 2, I will not share anything intimate about, you know, my relations with their mom or my present wife. But everything else is on the table. And so there's sometimes as they got toward the teens, older teens and early 20s, where inside I was cringing, like, I really don't want to hear this. But, you know, I did listen. And so just a total open door communication with them. I mean, even When my daughter was growing up, her friends were amazed at the things we talked about. He's like, "You tell your dad that?" And she's like, "Well, yeah." And the one daughter that's the fundraiser, she calls me every day. I at least get one call a day. The youngest, who's still here, sometimes I'll be watching TV and I can tell he wants to talk. And so he'll sit down and we'll talk for hours just to him bouncing stuff off of me about experiences. And so I'm very adamant that it's important, especially the fathers who sometimes tend not to engage verbally, to really be there to talk and communicate with your child, because they will learn from your experiences, your mistakes, how you fixed your mistakes, et cetera. And I think that's really, really helpful to them. I mean, my son thinks our conversation is so good. He said, "We should have a podcast."
Yeah, that would be great. Like, just, you know, because there are, I feel like it's easier just in general for kids, I think, to go to their mothers for things. And I think moms are a little bit more naturally open to those things. But to have a father that's open to that is really important. And especially like, you know, daughter, dad, I'm like that with my dad, you know, very open. And it's nice to have that relationship. So I'm sure your kids are just so grateful for that as well. Especially
in some situation, it's kind of reverse. They find it easier to talk to me because I try to have a no judgment zone. And, you know, I'm like, "I'll only tell your mother if she has to know something. But otherwise, you know, this is between me and you. And I'm going to try not to judge you. I'm going to have an opinion."
Right.
And you have three options: that I just listen, I listen and ask questions, or I listen, ask questions, and give my opinion.
I love
advice,
that.
Or whatever you want to call it. So that's the three levels of conversations we have. It seems to work out pretty good.
That's great, because sometimes that's all they need is just to listen. That's it. So what is one piece of advice you would give to other parents?
Well, again, to talk, to totally have that open door for communication at any time, because this is a crazy world right now and so many things happening. So many things coming at them, social media, the political scene, et cetera. And they, rather than have them rely on people their age or at their experience level, for a lot of them it's zero, just make sure that you are available to talk to them. And if they need to see a counselor, mental health treatment is taboo in some cultures and in some parts of the United States. But I've always urged my kids, if you can't talk to me, talk to somebody. Do not let this fester and grow. Talk to your minister, talk to counselors, talk to school counselors, but get help. Do not let this just fester, because it'll get out of your hands quickly if you don't address it. And so just trying to stress communication and communication styles, I think, will help parents a long way.
That's wonderful advice. Well, thank you for sharing all that. Let's move on to the meat of the conversation. Let's talk about you working for Consumer Reports. So can you share your journey and experience working as the Director of Food Safety Research and Testing at Consumer Reports?
Okay, so I mentioned I got my doctorate at University of Michigan in microbiology and immunology. Previously, I had my master's from Miami of Ohio, and I worked on amino acid biosynthesis. And so I've been in food and water microbiology for 30 years or more now. And so I just had a very deep background. And once the assistant professorship did not work out, I started exploring different jobs, and I ended up either a contractor or a federal employee. I first worked for the Navy, then the Army, working on biowarfare defense.
Wow.
And my team developed the methods for detecting biowarfare agents in food.
Wow.
And so this was part of the Food Emergency Response Network that started up back, you know, during 9/11, where we were trying to really get as many resources in place in case we were attacked in that way. And, and my team was part of that. And so I did that for a while, but then I wanted something a little bit closer to home. And so I started working with the Department of Agriculture, USDA, at Food Safety Inspection Service. And I started out there doing baseline surveys, which was basically testing the food to determine what bacteria were there and at what levels. And then we would set performance standards. And these were standards that the industry had to meet with their products. So if I test for the bacteria Salmonella, we would eventually say, okay, industry, out of 30 samples a month, you can only have 10 positive for Salmonella. That's an example of a performance standard. Then I wandered around, and within FSISN, you noted in one of the questions that I guess we'll come to is the Federal Advisory Committee, the National Advisory Committee for the Microbiological Criteria for Foods. I started running that for FSIS. I also worked with the Chief Scientist's Office for a while. And then I guess I started getting a little antsy. So I'd worked in academia. I'd worked as a contractor. I'd worked for Department of Defense and now a regulatory agency. But I'd never worked for a nonprofit, and I'd never worked for the food industry itself in the private sector. So this position at Consumer Reports became available, and it was basically to revive their food testing efforts because it had been dormant for a while. And it sounded interesting. It sounded new. I love building teams and groups from scratch. Mm-hmm. And I was given kind of a blank slate to say, we need to get this revived. And so I left what they call my good government job, took this position at a nonprofit to rebuild this team. And that was the start of my journey there. We'll probably talk about this a little later, but I wanted to introduce risk-based testing at Consumer Reports. And using the resources that I had, I was able to build a team that composes now of two chemists, one at the PhD level. I have an assistant who's a microbiologist. She has her PhD. I have a registered dietitian on staff. And then I recently was given product safety. And so I have two staff members that test products for their safety. Okay. So I have food safety, nutrition, and product safety all under my mantle right now. Yeah. And so whatever resources I get, we put forth to buy samples, test samples, report out the data. And then one of my favorite efforts is consumer education. So I love doing podcasts like yours. I love talking to people. I love giving lectures or whatever. And my last lecture was about food safety communication. How do you communicate to an audience that can vary in race, in culture, and age? And how do you communicate that your food safety information to them? And I never thought I'd be doing anything like this. I thought I'd be toiling away at a bench all my professional life. But as a result of what I'm doing now, I've been on television and radio and podcasts, and I enjoy every minute of it. Sometimes it's scary. Sometimes I'm scared when I'm about to try to lose my voice, but I've enjoyed it the entire, entire journey.
You're doing great things, and people need to know, and people need to be aware of all of this. And that's actually how I actually got into podcasts, by listening to the Rich Roll podcast. When I was training for my for the New York City Marathon, I would listen to his podcast all the time. And he really got me into like all of the information, because he kind of goes like way more in depth than anything that I had listened to before with his guests. And it just opened my eyes so much. And stuff like this, exactly what you're doing for Consumer Reports, is just along those same levels. So I feel really honored to be able to put a podcast like this out. So thank you. So in your role at Consumer Reports, what are the key challenges you face when it comes to ensuring food safety for consumers?
Well, the main one, as I mentioned, is that we're a nonprofit.
Yeah.
And so the organization does not accept advertising on the website or in the magazine. And so we rely on the generosity of consumers to members, fundraising, grants, et cetera, to fund our food safety testing. And so that means that the number of projects that I can do and the size of projects I can do is totally dependent on my resources. I have a great team, and sometimes I get frustrated because I'd love to be doing more. I was speaking to a podcaster before because we have tested baby food on a kind of a every four or five year rhythm. And I said, I would love to do that more. I said, I would love to do it yearly. Mm-hmm. I would love to have a baby monitoring program to see the levels of heavy metals in baby food, just to make sure that mothers, children's fathers are knowing what the safer products are out there. But I just don't have the resources to do that. And so one of my challenges is trying to help the organization not only put out good work, and important work, but also to help with resources and fundraising and finance and so on. And so that's one of my big frustrations, because I wish I could do more, because I do care and I wish I could do more. So.
Well, I'm sure you will accomplish so much, but yes. And it, along the lines of the baby food, most people, you know, the biggest thing is most people aren't waiting 5 years to have kids. So I think that would be such, you know, a great thing if you could get it done. For, you know, my kids are 18 months apart. So like, I don't know if something's changed since, you know, my daughter has been eating the food and so on and so on. So I think that would definitely be something eventually, if you could be so helpful for mothers, because everything is, you know, either you can't do it or you're doing it wrong, or, and if you could know, like, safely that you're doing it right, it would be very helpful.
Plus, the food space is very dynamic. It changes. For example, we tested baby food for heavy metals. And, you know, we reported the brands that had the most heavy metals, especially lead and arsenic. And then we retested 5 years later, and we could not find half the samples that we had found previously that had high levels of heavy metals, because they had either been discontinued or reformulated, et cetera. And so it is a dynamic space, and it's always changing. And so what we find, and we always say this is a snapshot into this particular group of foods, because we do know that, number one, we couldn't test everything. We tend to test the top 5 to 10 brands based on sales. And number two, we know it's dynamic. So even sometimes if we take too long to report what we actually tested, and then if we ask the question, is it still on the market 7-8 months later, sometimes it's not even on the market anymore, or it's been reformulated, or it's repackaged. And so it gets frustrating to try to keep as much information out there. Now, one thing is that there are other groups that test the same things that we test. So maybe we're testing in 2023. Maybe someone else will test in 2024. So one of the challenges consumers have is knowing where to get the right data that they can trust and understand, but also realizing that you may have to go to multiple places to grab this data. And then do the analysis. And then what we say is then use that to make your shopping list. Right. And so that's probably one of the more frustrating things in my job, along with the other, you know, normal day to day stuff. So,
yeah, it's so interesting to hear the behind the scenes of it all, too, because, again, we see we just see the headline, and it's, and to know all the stuff that goes behind it is very important. So you just talked a little bit about the testing and evaluation. What do you think sets it apart, though, in terms of consumer advocacy, like for consumer reports? How do you set it apart? The selection process, you said you take like the top 10, but and the testing efforts based on risk. What, you know, what do you think that whole process is like in regards to kind of setting it apart from other area, other researching facilities?
Well, maybe it'll help if I walk you through the process real quick, and then I'll tell you what we do at the end. So, like I said, we do risk-based testing. So what we do is we go out there and we look at the literature, we look at illness data, and we ask the question, what are the food contamination combinations that are making people sick? Sometimes they kill people. But what is the literature telling us about what's out there that's bad for consumers? We also talk to our laboratories that we use for testing. We consider them partners. And we'll ask them, what are you seeing come through the door that may not be above a certain threshold where the regulatory agencies are starting to get concerned? but that you're seeing a certain food being contaminated with a certain contaminant. And should we test it? Because we usually have a much bigger audience than the food testing lab.
Right.
And so what we do is at the beginning of the fiscal year, we all sit down at a table, and that includes myself, our advocacy partner, Brian Ronholm, and his staff. In fact, he was on that Netflix special.
The twins one?
The poison one.
Oh, okay, okay.
About food safety.
Okay.
Our content staff who will write these articles. We sit down with our social media staff who will be, and we say, okay, this is what we think. This is what we are concerned about. This is what the data is saying. This is what the literature is saying. And then I call it a WWE cage match because I have X number of dollars. I can do Y number of projects. So who gets the slot, right?
Right.
And you justify us testing, we'll test. Okay. Now, what we've recently also introduced is smaller tests, like 5 to 10 samples. We consider a large test above 50.
Okay.
So a smaller test that's faster. Then once we select the products, we go to our market analyst and we say, tell us, okay, let's say I wanted to test dog food, beef dog food. I'll go to my market analyst and I'll say, okay, tell us the top 10 dog food products and give me all the marketing information, all the background information. And then what we'll do is actually go shopping. And
okay.
So we send out secret shoppers and we buy them at retail. We buy it online, et cetera. And we take all those products. We write everything down off the label. And then we send it out to a testing lab for testing. And then we get the data and we analyze it. And then we'll say, for instance, if we wanted to test dog food for vitamin K levels, because that's supposed to be important, which of the dog foods had high, low, or medium, or the right amount of vitamin K, and then we'll write it up and we'll publish the story. Then Brian Ronholm and his advocacy team will take that, and if they think a federal regulatory agency such as the FDA that regulates dog food should do something about dog food, he'll talk to them, petition them, we'll meet with them and urge them to do that. We have a group at Consumer Reports that will do campaigns, advocacy campaigns, and write petitions and so on and so forth. We'll publish the article online, maybe in the magazine. We'll have the social media crew hit TikTok and Instagram and Facebook with this data and this information. And along the way, urge consumers that if you're concerned about this, write your congressperson, write the company, vote with your dollars, sign our petitions. And so I think that whole farm to fork, if you want to call it that, but grocery store to fork process is unique and different because as far as I know, there are not a lot of consumer groups that test as much as we do.
Okay.
Now, there are some, and we consider them partners in this effort that do, but not as much as we do. I try to get about 3 to 4 major projects done a year, and then about 5 to 7 of those smaller projects done. On the nutrition side, my nutritionist, I only have one. I don't have a lot of people. So her capacity is usually 2 or 3 larger projects and a few smaller projects. And that's kind of our flow of projects. And so, again, I think what makes us unique is that we test more and we try to connect it directly to an advocacy campaign and publications on the web and our magazine, which is Legacy, depending on the story, to get that information out there. I hope that answers the question.
Yeah, no, that's really informative because that is something that, again, we don't really know. You see this like headline and you're like, did they just test like one thing? Do they test a million things? But knowing the background of it is great. So you did mention farm to table. So can you elaborate on the significance of the National Advisory Committee on Microbiological Criteria of Food?
We call it NACMF.
NACMF. Okay.
Yeah.
What is the role for ensuring the food safety from farm to table?
So this Federal Advisory Committee was part of the whole Federal Advisory Committee's system that was set up by our federal government in order to put together groups of experts in their area to advise various federal agencies on their policies, on their procedures, on their efforts, et cetera. The USDA, the CDC, the FDA, NOAA, because they have some of the fishery safety under them, the DOD, because our troops have to be fed when they're on deployment or whatever, and many times they have to buy the food in the country that they're stationed, and that country may not have the same food safety regulations as we do. And so we helped them during my tenure actually set up, these are the criteria that as you're buying food from different vendors, let's say in Turkey or whatever, you hand them this document, translated in their language, and these are the criteria that you need to follow in order if you're going to supply my army or my navy to make sure my troops stay safe and do not get a foodborne illness. So each of those organizations has the ability to give what's called a charge to NACMIT to say, well, we are concerned about this aspect of food safety. I just mentioned one, the DOD charge that we did about the food safety criteria when we're deployed. Or if we're USDA, they could say, well, we're concerned about salmonella and poultry. What's the best way to test? And then NACMIT will pull together experts from the federal government, from academia, from the private sector, and from consumer groups. I mean, I'm on a federal advisory committee myself, and then my counterpart in Brian's shop, he's on another federal advisory committee. And we all come together, they present the charge to us, and then we all go into our little groups and we start working on the charge and we publish a paper and hand the document to that federal agency that wanted this to be worked on. And what's unique is that NACMIT made sure that it had representation from all of those groups,
Wow,
right?
that's
Because
great.
if it was just the federal government and not the private sector, we wouldn't get their perspective on this food safety issue. And so, using that system, there have been a number of very important food safety recommendations and advice that made its way into the federal regulatory system for food, such as I mentioned about DLD. That was a charge we had. We had a charge about how should FDA regulate certain strains of E. coli that made people sick? How should they test? How should they detect, et cetera? And so, NACMIT every year or two, probably usually on a 2 year, they'll have a new set of charges. They'll work on it. They'll deliver the document. Then it's up to that federal agency that asked for it to implement the recommendations of NACMIT. And so that's why that was so unique. But I think also it was very important that these federal agencies involved in food, because there's like 16 different federal agencies that work on food
There's a
safety
lot.
Departments and stuff, but that they can go to NACMIT and actually get this advice, which I thought was very important. And I really enjoyed my time just sitting in a room of world-class experts, hearing them debate different points. And so my perspective was to hold all that stuff together, to recruit the committee members, fly them into wherever we were going to meet, make sure they had everything they needed, and then kind of shepherd that document through, the different groups and finally present that document. And it ended up also being published as a peer-reviewed journal paper to that federal agency so they could then utilize the advice that was contained inside.
Wow, that's a lot. So, given your expertise in this area, how do you balance educating the consumers about the potential hazards, but also not causing unnecessary panic? Because you can fall under that.
Well, whenever I'm interviewed about a report, my first thing is to say, number one, do not panic, right? Because at least the last couple of food testing projects we did, it was describing problems that are chronic in nature, not acute. Now, chronic means that the effects are usually long term and over a couple of years. So it's not like whatever we find in this product and you eat it, you're going to die like that, right? So chronic and do not panic, which means you have some time to deal with this. Whatever damage was done before now, we can't correct. But especially for children, pregnant women, babies, we can stop this right now so it doesn't become an issue down the road. Mm-hmm. Okay. And so first we say, don't panic. Second, we say, not everything that we tested was bad.
Right.
And so you have some options. Now, in some cases, for certain populations, we recommend you don't eat it. So in our dark chocolate story, the dark chocolate bars we tested, if you read the article, either on the website cr.org, it says, for pregnant people and for young children, we recommend that you limit or eliminate dark chocolate because the heavy metals that we found, cadmium and lead, can affect the developing fetus and can affect the young people as they grow because they're in such a rapid growth state that the effects of these chemicals are much more acute at this part of their life than if you're an old guy like me, right?
Yeah.
And so we try to give options. We try to give choices. We try to help people navigate this. And we try to tell them, we're trying to reduce your risk.
Right.
Maybe we can get it to zero. But if we can't get it to zero, we can get it as low as possible. And here's how we suggest you do it. But always talk to your doctor. Always talk to your nutritionist if you want to. The other thing is that we try to dispel myths. So, for instance, organic means a certain thing, right? But eating organic will not help you avoid these heavy metals because that has nothing to do with the heavy metal concentration or presence in the product. So some people say, well, I just eat organic. Well, no, for this particular problem, it doesn't make a difference. And our testing shows that. And we say that, too. So the whole thing is to get people to calm down, relax, but also let's be strategic in your food purchases, selection and purchase, consumption, frequency of consumption, amount of consumption, so that you can reduce your risk exposure to these chemicals and problems, possible problems.
That's great advice. So,
I hope I got that for you.
No, that's awesome. And actually with the testing of the chocolate bars, I was going to ask that like in this section, but then I kind of switched it to when we get down to, but that's awesome. I'm so glad that you answered that. It just, you know, when you read it again, you're not sure like what demographic should be eating these chocolates. And we'll get more into that in a little bit. But
well, I think it's important, though, that because you hit on a very important point, because even my daughter will say, oh, that's something else I can't eat. And I'm like, no, that's not what I'm saying. But I think it's very important that we try not to use scare tactics. We don't want to make people afraid because we believe that then you're going to make worse choices and we don't want to lose you. And we want to be able to help walk you through this process of eating better, eating healthier. And so at least under my watch, you'll never see a story that's a scare tactic story.
Yeah. So. And that was kind of going to be what my next question was, like, what are some common misconceptions about food safety that you do encounter? Like anything additionally to the myths, like how do you make sure that the myths don't get out there? Or how do you ensure that your headlines are written in a way that it doesn't cause rumors or things that you don't want?
Well, what we try to do at Consumer Reports is point consumers to accurate, clear information. And so what I will say is, please read our article, read similar articles. Sometimes those articles are referenced in our online or in the magazine itself for additional information. We'll point them to the federal government, except I have a pet peeve that sometimes it's kind of convoluted to find stuff on their websites. They're doing better over the last couple years of trying to make their information and their advice much more understandable. When I was there 7 years ago, it was terrible. They didn't use social media. It was a very blocky type of way of reporting stuff out, but they're trying to do better at reporting their things. We also talk about beware of social media.
I know.
Lot of stuff on social media is inaccurate.
Right.
Sometimes it could be dangerous. And sometimes the people that are purporting it are actually being paid to, you know, advertise or to sell something, and they have no food safety or nutrition background. So we caution people not to trust social media to whatever you see on social media, unless it does come from the federal government, because they've increased their social media presence.
Yeah.
Check it out with additional sources. Do not take an influencer's word for it. That's another pet peeve of myself and my nutritionist, Amy Keating. We're trying to figure out a way how to get bad nutrition information off the social media, but yeah. We haven't figured out a way, unless I want to get into a war with like the Kardashians and their flat tummy tea or something.
Yeah,
which I really don't have time for that right now, but it is an important issue for us.
No, I totally agree with that, because I was just going to say, like, I know there's like different sides of TikTok if you're on mm-hmm. that, and whatever you're consuming, there's more mm-hmm. of it. So I feel like if you're consuming a lot of like the myths, but it is a specific topic, mm-hmm. you're going to get more of that specific topic talking about that mm-hmm. myth, but you think it's real. And the more you listen to it, you're like, oh yeah, this could be real, or this could be true. You know, mm-hmm. That is so difficult. And so many times when I see stuff on, whether it's Instagram or Facebook, I'm always like, is this real? Mm. Like, let me go Google this and figure out before I panic or whatever. Right. But it's hard. And like, I see it with the high school students that I teach. That's how they're getting their news and their information. Mm. You know, today, like, one of my students is talking to me about something because it's raining and windy here. And about power outages and this and that that he saw on TikTok. And it's like, it's not even raining right now. We're not panicking. Right. Let's calm down. Right. So, but I know how it parallels to the nutrition part. It's just whatever they want to say.
What we've tried to do is, one thing is that the FSIS, Food Safety Inspection Service, they have a service called Ask FSIS, mm-hmm. right?
Okay.
And so if you've gone to their website, and you search and you couldn't find what you needed, then there is that service that you could possibly get your question answered. Now, I mean, there's only a few people there, right. You know, so it may take a while, even if they decide to answer your question. But there are a number of different sites, even outside the federal government, some academic sites from food safety departments that are really good, that can give you advice too. There are also some, what I've learned over the last couple of years is there are also sites that are based on social media that's actually looking out there and trying to figure out if a particular foodborne outbreak is true.
Oh.
Iwaspoisoned.com is one of those.
Okay.
I know the guy who runs that. And what he does is, someone could say, okay, I ate a hamburger at McDonald's on 3rd Street and now I have diarrhea. And so if you put that out there in the wrong place, then all of a sudden people may be upset with that McDonald's. Mm-hmm. But his idea is, there has to be a number of reports of illnesses from that restaurant before we should be concerned about it. So let me try to gather this up, give it a score, and then I can send it out to my subscribers.
Right.
To see, you know, is there something to this claim?
That's smart.
So that's some of the things I've been watching, to try to be a little bit more ahead and predictive, but also to, in my mind, have the potential to push down this, excitability part of the social media, just because I report something happened to me doesn't necessarily mean it's true, because as you know, there's some people that may just have an issue with McDonald's and want to hurt them economically and just put out all this false reporting. But if you can find tools and use tools that can kind of aggregate this data and then make a judgment or a call, whether it's real, I think it helps. But like I said to you, we try to say, do not panic. Use our sources, use other sources, but also consider federal government websites. They're here to help. We pay for them with our taxes, so we should use them.
Yeah. All right. So let's move on to chocolate. Mm-hmm. So what motivated Consumer Reports to specifically test chocolate products for heavy metals? And what has the response from the industry and consumers been?
Okay. So our first foray into chocolate testing under my watch was the dark chocolate bars, which was a couple of years ago. And the reason why is that we have been doing a lot of work on heavy metals and PFAS, the forever chemicals in food. And, you know, we've done baby food. We've talked about that. We did water, both municipal water, bottled water. We did water, very extensive testing in the state of Mississippi of their tap water, well water for heavy metals and PFAS. So my chemist, Tunde Akaleya, he reads much more literature than I can. Mm-hmm. And he noticed that within certain food products, especially chocolate, there were reports of a problem with heavy metals, specifically cadmium and lead. And so we found some funding toward the end of one of the years. And we said, well, let's test 5, 10, 15 chocolate bars for cadmium and lead and see what we found. And if you remember that reporting, we did find it in, mm-hmm. in many of the bars. There were some bars that were lower, but it was only dark chocolate.
Okay.
And we had a number of consumers reach out to us and say, well, what about this chocolate product? What about Hershey's milk chocolate? What about Toll House chocolate chips, et cetera? Mm-hmm. And so we made testing more chocolate products a priority project. The middle of last year. And so we did the same thing. So we looked at cocoa powder used for baking. We looked at chocolate chips for chocolate chip cookies, milk chocolate bars instead of dark chocolate bars, brownie mixes, cake mixes, hot chocolate. But we did pull an additional set of dark chocolate bars into the testing so that we could flesh out the number of chocolate bars we totally tested. We included Hershey's, Ghirardelli, Nestle's, and then we shop, as I mentioned, we shop for the top brands and the numbers across the country.
Right.
Costco's, Trader Joe's, Target, Whole Foods, Walmart. And then we brought them in, we wrote everything down about them, then we sent them out to our lab to test. And the motivation basically was because consumers wanted us to. Mm-hmm. And so what we try to do is respond to consumers when we can. And this was something that they were very interested in. Plus, it was right before Halloween. Mm-hmm. It was right before Christmas. And so there was a heightened interest. The other thing, and you know, this is a little bit, you know, selfish on our part. The dark chocolate bar story was one of the largest stories that we ever had.
Wow.
In testing food. And so, you know, another thought in my mind was, well, does lightning strike twice?
Right.
And this was a really good story, too. And then I mentioned a number of the things that we also knew that there were certain specialty chocolate makers. So we tested products from Navitas and Drost.
Okay.
And so that was the motivation. And I could talk about the results if you want me to.
Yeah, but, if you want to talk about the results first, then we can go a little bit into some of the other stuff.
So one third of the products tested had worrisome levels. And we say worrisome levels because our federal government has not set levels for these heavy metals. So we had to use a standard that was generated out of California called the MADL, maximum allowable dose level. And we set a threshold based on the literature, safety literature, health literature, as to what should the cutoff be for these heavy metals. Mm-hmm. Some of the products are more than twice as high as that cutoff, right? Now, in general, the most concerning heavy metals were cadmium and lead, and I can talk about them in a minute. But milk chocolate, in general, were lower because the heavy metal contamination is associated with the level of cacao.
Okay.
And so the higher that you have, the darker the chocolate, the more chance you have of having this heavy metal. So milk chocolate has less of the cacao. It's sweeter. There's more milk and more sugar added to that. But they had less of the heavy metals, which is logical.
Yeah.
And then none of them exceeded the threshold for lead. And so that was a good thing.
That's good.
Now, Hershey's, even though it didn't exceed it, it was the one that had the highest levels of lead of all the milk chocolate bars, which is why we had the renewed petition of them to get the lead out that we talked about before.
Right.
Lead is considered not safe at any level.
Okay.
And so we want zero lead in all food products, but in this case, zero lead in all chocolate products.
Mm-hmm.
And in the article, we talked about how lead gets into chocolate, how cadmium. Lead is usually something that's an environmental contaminant. And one of the steps is to dry the chocolate beans out in the sun, in the air. But if you do that drying close to an industrial facility that manufactures lead, a highway where the cars are still using lead gasoline, a field that is being plowed that has a high concentration of lead, or is using an insecticide or herbicide that has lead in it, it blows onto the beans. And then you get them contaminated that way. Cadmium, on the other hand, is a heavy metal that usually is in the soil. And so when you're growing your chocolate trees where the soil is contaminated with the cadmium, it draws it up through the roots, goes through the tree, and then gets into the chocolate pods.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how you get cadmium into chocolate.
Okay.
And so our calls have been for the manufacturers to realize this. Process your chocolate seeds away from industrial or lead contaminated areas. Find places to grow your chocolate trees that don't have cadmium in the soil and, you know, grow them somewhere else. Test the incoming chocolate beans that are coming into your manufacturing plant and make sure you're not bringing in the chocolate seeds from highly contaminated areas. And then test your product as it goes out and prevent that product from going out that's high in lead too. One of the issues that we found in investigating the story is that a lot of times chocolate makers will blend seeds from different sources. Mm. And so it's kind of hard at the end to determine where that came from. So that's why we said test every lot.
Right.
You know, and
yeah.
Get rid of that lot that's high in cadmium or lead and only use the lots that are lower. And so we have had a number of conversations with chocolate manufacturers. Sometimes they say they're doing the best that they can. Sometimes they say, well, they meet a regulatory limit, but there isn't a regulatory limit. So they'll say, well, we meet a safe limit. Okay, well, there's no safe level of lead. And so it's kind of a back and forth
that
goes on. And so that's why Brian Ronholm and his advocacy folks start knocking on the doors of the FDA, which regulates chocolate, and says, you need to do something about this heavy metal contamination in foods, in chocolate in this case, because, you know, this shouldn't be here, and we're not getting any traction or fast enough traction with manufacturers of these products. And so that's kind of the efforts of why we try to do to try to address this.
So let's go on to, as we are approaching the Easter season, the Easter Bunny brings chocolates to everyone. And as you're talking, I'm thinking, oh my gosh, my daughter loves, you know, Hershey Kisses. That's like one of her treats. And I'm thinking, how much lead have I given her already? But, you know, with Easter around the corner, many families, they'll be indulging in chocolate. How can consumers make informed choices about the chocolate products, considering, you know, the potential health risks associated with heavy metals?
Yeah. So unfortunately, when we were testing, Easter candy was not out. In fact, the only thing that was out at that point that was seasonal was the Halloween candy.
Right.
So what we gave was general recommendations that would apply here too.
Mm-hmm.
We said milk chocolate is better than dark chocolate for kids.
Right.
Moderation is the key, that you use this as a treat, that you don't use it. I mean, even I used to eat a piece of dark chocolate every night. I've cut way back now. And I've gone to milk chocolate because, as we discussed, it has lower cacao, so it has lower potential of having lead and cadmium in it. And so that's what we say. It's basically regulate, moderate, and make the choices of doing milk chocolate rather than dark chocolate because of the previous association of these heavy metals with cacao levels too. Unfortunately, like I said, we did not test. I mean, Easter candy wasn't even available when we were testing, which kind of goes back to what I told you. I like to constantly monitor stuff if I could. I mean, I would love to test chocolate during every season.
But yeah,
just so we can make some recommendations. But, you know, we had to do what we had to do. So that's what I would say. Just you know, make sure it's a treat, and just make sure that you moderate what you eat, lower the consumption, even of milk chocolate, just to lower your exposure risk.
So are there any specific brands or types besides, you said milk chocolate, but are there any specific brands that you could look for as a safer alternative?
Samantha, I would love to refer your listeners and you to the article. Because it's much easier to go through that, because it's a pretty decent long list.
Right.
And
I'll link all that in there for the
We purposely do colors.
Right.
And we purposely try to chop it down when we can to red, green, yellow.
Right.
Brands. But in this study, I think what you'll see is that we highlighted the top one or top two products that had too much lead or cadmium. And then we advise you eat those that are lower in the chart. So I would like to advise your listeners to just go to the article and take a look there, and then use that as your guide of what you're going to purchase and consume of all the products we tested.
Yeah, that's great advice.
What I would urge you and your listeners to consider is just keeping an eye on what we put out, because like I mentioned, we do three big testing stories a year, maybe 5 to 7 smaller ones, plus the nutrition stories. Luckily, they like my food stuff, and so we're very, very busy.
Yeah.
Just recently, last week, a story on plasticizers in food came out. And it talks about two chemical groups that are used to manufacture plastic getting into our food. They've been associated with a number of problems. They're considered endocrine disruptors, which modulates your hormones such as estrogen.
Right.
And have been associated with obesity and some certain cancers, cardiovascular issues, infertility, reproductive problems, et cetera. And so I would suggest that your listeners take a look at those articles. There'll be something I can't say yet because we haven't finished it.
Yeah.
It's going to be something I think is very exciting later on in the year.
Yeah.
Look at our article on spices that we did, looking at heavy metals and spices. I suggested that story. I thought it was important.
Yeah.
Because as our population becomes much more diverse with different cultures and different cooking cultures, the source of spices can make a difference whether the heavy metal levels are in the spices. And even people that are not from, let's say, India still try to cook Indian, and they still try to use those spices. So it's not just culture specific either.
Right.
That flows throughout the population. And so we've had some very interesting findings of spices and heavy metal contaminations, et cetera. And that's another story I'd love to do again at some point, because as we just talked about, it's a very fluctuating source of food and types of spices and stuff. And so we may find some additional information if we test it again. But I'm on to something else right now. So
yeah. Oh my gosh. So much. You'll have to come back on and talk about another Gladly. One. Yeah. Another, Gladly. Either the plastics or at the end of the year, I'd love to have you back on because this was so informative. Okay. And answered so many questions about everything I didn't know, which is great.
Okay.
So I think we're going to end it there. That's going to bring us to the end of another episode of The Running Wine Mom. As we wrap this episode up, I'd like to express our gratitude to Dr. Rogers for sharing his expertise and shedding light on the crucial aspects of food safety, particularly in the realm of chocolate consumption. Remember, our choices matter, and being informed consumers allows us to enjoy our favorite treats while prioritizing our health. And as always, if you enjoyed this episode, please consider subscribing, leaving a review, and sharing it. You can follow me on Instagram at @therunningwinemom_. And Dr. Rogers, can you tell everyone where they can find you at?
So I work for Consumer Reports, and all of our information are on cr.org. And if you want to contact me, my contact information is on our website. I'm one of the, I guess they call it staff experts in food safety. And so you can find me there.
Yeah. And
on LinkedIn. I'm on there too.
And I will link all that in the show notes as well. So thank you for joining us today. Remember, you are strong, you are capable, and you are all amazing. Until next time, keep running, keep sipping, and keep enjoying the joys of parenthood. Cheers. And I will be back next Tuesday.